The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
And welcome to the College Football Podcast. Kirk Herbstreit and Kevin Negandhi with you. Hoping everybody had a great new year as we are now in 2021. And plenty to dissect and, of course, get reaction to after what we saw over the weekend, and also prepare for what will happen next Monday, a week from today, which is the national championship in Miami. And it features, no surprise, Alabama. Maybe a small surprise in Ohio State, just because not so much the team that's there, it's how they did it. Herbie, we'll get to that in a moment. But first off, I want to tell you that as a guy that's in the business, that understands the challenges, you were in a unique situation and setting. And first off, how you feeling as you were dealing with coronavirus? And secondly, the challenge that you faced on Friday, calling a game like that of that magnitude at home.
I appreciate it, bud. I've been watching this pandemic and try to do the best I can to follow every bit of advice we can get about, social distancing and cleaning your hands and all that, and wearing a mask. And I've honored that. I was kind of proud. I was, probably like you. You got a test every so often for us out on the road. We got a test every week, and every time it'd come back not detected, I'd be like, yes, another week we got through. And then right when you get to the most important part of the season, you end up testing positive, and on the Monday leading into the game. And man, I just thought, there's no way. So I went back again the next day just to see, because I the only symptoms I was feeling is kind of like I am now, just a bad head cold. I've lost complete taste. I've lost complete smell. So, I've heard that from a lot of other people, and I can testify that that's 1,000% accurate in my case. But I brought it up to Lee Fitting and Steve Ackles and the guys. Is there any way we can try to figure out a way that I can still call the game? Because I came back again Tuesday, again positive. And they just put a plan together. I quarantined and stayed away from my basement. And they had a Carl Heineman, who helps me with my Sports Center hits that I do with you and the Tuesday night show. He came in and was able to set everything up. It took him about 3 days to get everything set up. And I was able to do game day in the morning. And then the tough part, I just want to make sure the technical crew gets their due, because anybody who's analyzed a game, in college football or football of any kind, what you do when you're doing a game is you watch the field, with your eyes. You're watching the field. The only time you really look at a monitor when you're doing a game is on a replay or graphic, just to understand what the viewer at home is seeing. So you really never, at least in my case, you never really watch the monitor unless there's a replay coming up. So what you lose is the ability to see safeties moving, coverage, different aspects, what's going on in the sideline, communication. There's just so many things that happen to help you analyze a game. But what they were able to put together gave me at least a chance to see what was happening and be in real time with Chris. Usually, like when I do SportsCenter with you, I'm about a second and a half, almost 2 second delay to your question. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing that game, I have no idea how they technically did it, but there was a very, very slight delay, if any at all, which allowed Chris, who was on site, and me, who was in Nashville, to be able to do the game somewhat seamlessly as far as timing is concerned. But I was just happy I could do the game. I obviously wished I could be there, and just happy that that I'm on the back end of this as far as 10 days, being isolated, and I'll be able to go down to Miami and get ready to call the Ohio State Alabama game. Looking forward to it. But I feel fine, man. I just dealing with still some symptoms that are lingering.
Well, I'm glad you're okay. That's, of course, the most important thing. And I saw the setup that ESPN PR put out there with the monitors. And You know, the most important thing, like you said, was tracking where the ball is, right? Because your eyes are always you have the viewpoint of not the all 22s, but it's the side view, right, of the all 22s. Yeah. And at the same time, you can anticipate a throw down the field. You can anticipate certain things where your eyes are looking somewhere else. And I go back to you brought it up. I thought about the delay issue, and for you not to have any issues on the delay, it changes the entire approach to the broadcast, especially for the listening audience. So it's a huge credit to, like you mentioned, the crew, the engineering crew, and the production crew, headlined by Lee Fitting and company, to make sure it happens, and Ed Placey and everybody that's involved in taking care of that. And yeah, the way the game played out, you could say amazing too if you're a Buckeye fan, right? Because how things looked in the beginning, it felt like Ohio State was out of sorts. I was there, and you know, you see the crowd. It's just a different vibe. And, you know, in the beginning, you're just like, how are they going to create their own juice in a game like this? And I know it's the playoff. You don't need to create juice. But still, that plays a role with momentum to a certain extent. And it felt like, well, Ohio State's going to – they're trying to find their rhythm in this game early on. And then – over time, and you brought this up on the podcast last week, over time, you saw the domination of a couple of things. You saw the domination of the defensive front. You saw the domination of that offensive line that we saw carried over from the Northwestern game. And then to me, what stood out was Ryan Day's play calling. Some of those wrinkles that you saw that we didn't see, at least for the majority of the season in their six games heading into this. From your perspective, what stood out and how Ohio State did what they did to take control of the game?
Well, first, I mean, because it ended up being, you know, mostly you look at the score 49-28, Ohio State really pulled away with the game. You go back to the beginning of the game, all the buildup. Remember, this is still Clemson. You know, there's still a presence about that brand, and they score eight plays. I think it was like 82 yards. Boom, it's 7-0 Clemson. Ohio State gets the ball, and they were really kind of testing things. I think just kind of feeling things out. They go three and out, and it's a punt. And at that point, you're thinking, okay, this could get interesting here. And then Ohio State gets Clemson right off the field, a three and out. And then the reason I bring all this back is just to remind people, Justin Fields checks down to Trey Sermon off to his right. Trey Sermon ends up picking up a lot. I think he got like over 30 yards on that check down. And the very next play was a precursor for, to me, the entire night. You talked about Ryan Day and a few wrinkles. Ryan Day, without saying anything, kind of talked about how Brent Venables is so good at understanding offensive and their formations, their personnel groupings, waits to the last second. Some people interpreted that, oh, he's stealing signs. I think Ryan Day was just saying, listen, he's very good. His guys are all in tune with him, checking over to the sideline, trying to make sure everyone's on the same page. Well, he came up with you know, some wrinkles of just trying to change his tempo. Sometimes he'd go really fast. Sometimes he would wait, and they'd be looking over the sidelines. Justin Fields would be waiting, 15, 12, no call yet from the sideline. And then under 10 seconds, call, boom, get to the line of scrimmage fast, and snap the ball. And if you go after that Sermon check down, they did that very thing. They waited. It wasn't like, oh, we're going to hurry up and go fast. If you go back and watch that play, and I think we even pointed out in the broadcast, there wasn't that typical super tempo, go fast after the Sermon, let's get them out of position. It was leisurely go back to the line of scrimmage, let them spot the ball. Fields is kind of looking over. There's no sense of, oh, they're going to catch Brent Venables napping kind of thing. Nothing like that. And then about 10 seconds to go on the play clock, they went fast. And that's when Clemson was still looking over to the sideline. And then he snaps the ball, and they're trying to run and get in position. And they go outside zone left, and Clemson didn't have enough people over there. And Sermon goes for a 32-yard touchdown, and it's 7-7. And for me, calling the game, I don't know how you felt just watching. For me, I was like, uh-oh, this is interesting. At least from an Ohio State offensive standpoint, against the Clemson defense, because I thought we might be onto something here early, that Fields, you could also see and feel. Fields from the Big Ten Championship, and I don't want to take anything away from Northwestern and what they did to him. Olave not being there, mm-hmm. Fields was out of rhythm. He was out of sorts. He didn't have that normal look in his eye. Very first play on, Fields looked dialed in. So when you combine Ryan Day, mixing the combinations of tempo, and Justin Fields locked in, razor-focused, and then you think about the underrated on a national level, Chris Olave, Garrett Wilson, those big tight ends, Trey Sermon. I don't think people on a national level, when they watched that game at the beginning, had the respect that they probably should have for Wilson, Olave, Sermon, the two big tight ends, Farrell and Ruckert. I think they look at Ohio State as you know, Justin Fields is good, and, you know, Olave is pretty good, and they don't know anything about the tight ends. Sermon was good when he was at Oklahoma. He had that one game in the Big Ten Championship. I think that was kind of the national perception. Mm-hmm. And then I think as the game went on, people started to really see, wow, these guys are legit. I mean, these vertical threats at receiver. Sermon, Trey Sermon is running the ball right now as good as any running back in the country. He's showing elusiveness. He's showing power. He's showing vision, balance. He's a complete back. And it's crazy. You go back, he tore an LCL, which took him about 4 months to recover in the middle of a pandemic, and worked hard. He went down to Houston, worked with his speed coach, came back. And even then, you go back to the first three or four games of the season, he was kind of still feeling his way in a new system. And from about the Michigan State game on, just a different guy. And so, yeah, I mean, that didn't necessarily surprise me. The biggest surprise, if I had any, I knew the Ohio State defensive line had a very good chance to win the battle at the line of scrimmage. I wondered how the linebackers would play in space, and I wondered how the secondary would do against Trevor Lawrence and his weapons. And they did incredibly well. And that defensive line, Larry Johnson, he gets a lot of credit for Joey Bosa, Nick Bosa, and Chase Young. But if you go back and really watch guys like Sam Hubbard, Tyquan Lewis, Jalen Holmes, I mean, they've had some monsters that have come through there. Draymond Jones, and he's got a great group that he's working with right now. And I think collectively that defense really played with that chip on their shoulder that carried them throughout the 60 minutes of football. They negated the run game and got pressure on Trevor Lawrence most of the game.
Yeah, Garrett was tremendous, carried over from the Big Ten Championship game, and Togi Ai as well. It goes to the other side as well, right? Where the conversation is, how much did this offense miss a rhythm with Tony Elliott there as the OC? How much do you put into that? Because there are certain times you're watching this game and you're waiting, right? Once Ohio State have figured things out and they're moving the football and they're scoring at will, and it's like 28-14 at one point, and I'm starting to think, like, all right, when's Clemson going to flip the switch here, right? When are they going to get back on track like we saw a year ago where they were down and they found a way to just basically say, Trevor Lawrence is going to carry us? How much do you play into something like this where the play calling and finding any type of rhythm for Trevor Lawrence and taking advantage of people on the outside? It didn't seem like they could find any type of rhythm.
Well, in all fairness to Brandon Streeter, who called plays, you know, he's had a history in his background of calling plays at Liberty and Richmond. He's involved in the week-long prep that Tony Elliott and his team lead. But he's a quarterback coach right at this point in his career at Clemson. And so Tony Elliott has become one of the better in-game ability to adjust in-game and call plays and find weaknesses is, to me, is as much as anybody in the country. So I think if you saw the first drive, they were on the script that Tony Elliott and Dabo and the whole team prepared, and they were right down the field and scored. My concern with not having Tony Elliott was the continuity, the rhythm of, okay, now we see what they're doing. Now we're off the script. Now we got to kind of go with what we think is working based on what they're doing. And Brandon Streeter, you know, one day he's going to be a great play caller and probably be a great head coach. But you take away, let's reverse the roles. Let's say Tony Elliott was the quarterback coach and Brandon Streeter was the play caller all these years. It'd be the same thing. It's just Tony Elliott's role and how he has grown and how important of a spot he has in that offense. It'd be like you take Ryan Day, you know, Kevin Wilson stepped in and he's got a little bit more, not a little, a lot more experience as a play caller at Oklahoma and Indiana. Ohio State had to deal with that at Michigan State. So it'd be, if you imagine taking Sark away from Nick Saban right now, I don't know who would step up, but it would probably be, oh boy, what are we going to do now? Kind of thing. And so that was evident. I don't know if it would have made a huge difference just because I think the way Ohio State played and how well prepared they were. But of course, anytime you take away, there was another guy named Cam Akin, that's a senior analyst who also was out for Clemson. And he sits right to the right. You call him a right hand man of Tony Elliott in the box. He's out as well. So you got Tony Elliott out, you got Cam Akin out. And you got Brandon Streeter and Dabo and the rest of the offensive staff trying to make adjustments, and you're losing the line of scrimmage. You know, as the game's going on, it's becoming more and more evident that Togiai and Garrett in the middle are winning and dominating. You can't run the ball. They're trying to get the ball out on the edge. And Ohio State's speed, their linebacker play, Pete Werner and Tuff Borland, Justin Hilliard, Baron Browning, those guys were outstanding in space. Yeah, I think it's a fact. I don't think it's an excuse, but I think it's something you should recognize that affected some of the continuity and maybe the offensive rhythm. But you also have a 3-year starting quarterback in Trevor Lawrence that can help maybe overcome some of those concerns. But I would, when I look back at this game, I think it's more about an Ohio State team that walked out of Glendale. They felt they outplayed Clemson for the most part of that game and didn't close in the red zone, had a few calls go against them. And they were irate getting onto those team buses. I was down there in the bowels of that stadium, and I could look in the eyes and talk with Ryan Day and some of those players. It wasn't just your normal, man, we lost a game. It was, we got jobbed. We outplayed them. How did we lose this game? Unbelievable. We should be going on to play LSU. It wasn't one or two guys. It was everyone. And so when they got on those buses, I don't think they got that taste out of their mouth until they got back onto that field. And think about what they'd been through. I mean, you not only go back and do winter conditioning with 29-23 up on the board as you're working out, you go into a global pandemic, you go into a quarantine, you go into your season being canceled. You go back to multiple weeks later, the season's back on. Then you're going to play 8 games. Then you lose a few games because of the COVID virus and teams having to forfeit games or suspend games. And now are they going to play enough games? They shouldn't be allowed in. They only played 6. All this is building up in them as they get an opportunity of all teams that they get. I mean, the football gods, how ironic through all that, they team them up with Clemson in a rematch. And so I don't think Tony Elliott and all that, I think it was more about you had a possessed football team on your hands that went through hell and back to get back into that position. And that's why when Justin Fields got hit, unless he ruptured a spleen or had, you know, he was spitting up blood, in my mind, there was no way, knowing that young man, there was no way, after all I just described, that number one was coming off the field, even though he took that hit. And I think that hit, and 2 plays later, that touchdown, 20 years from now, that's what Ohio State fans will remember. That's what college football fans will remember, is kind of the will and the toughness of Fields that, to me, kind of represented the entire Ohio State party that showed up to the Superdome that night.
Yeah, and it combined with, you know, it's not the factor, but it's still one of those, you're tossing a piece of wood already on a fire that's brewing with, you know, Dabo ranking them 11th. And he explained it's nothing personal, but it comes still. Ohio State does a really good job of taking everything personal in a sense that we are going to rally around this, right? And it's not just the team, it's the fan base. And you, we talked to Ryan Day the day of game of the game, right after he stepped off the set at game day, and they felt, I mean, the same theme you talked about on the bus after the game in Glendale was the same vibe we got that morning talking to Ryan, that, hey, there were three things that stood out from a year ago. We felt like we should have won. And there was a certain confidence that we just want the rematch. And we've got the rematch. And you brought up Fields' performance, six touchdowns. Where will this go in Ohio State lore, regardless of what happens next week? I know you mentioned 20 years, but you being a Buckeye, you know, through and through, generation to generation, was this a top three performance? I want your historical perspective. You don't need to kind of drop other performances, but just off the top of your head, is this a top three performance all time, considering the stakes and what he dealt with and then how he delivered?
Absolutely. I mean, I go back a long way with Ohio State football, really college football, you know, and of course, growing up in Ohio, and the fact that I've told you my dad played there, I was a pretty brainwashed growing up in Ohio in the 70s, Ohio State football fan, going back to Woody Hayes and Archie Griffin and Art Schlichter and all that. And I'm not saying there weren't Ohio State players that had to overcome adversity. I can't think of on that kind of stage with so much at stake to take a hit like that. And to go down, and many holding their breath, hoping he's okay, forget the game for a second, is Justin okay? And for him to check out and to go out for a play at a really critical moment in the game, and then to come back and throw a touchdown pass perfectly timed up to Olave in the corner. By the way, hits Olave, who dealt with his own ghost from last year in that final play that Nolan Turner intercepted. How fitting that he hits Olave on that touchdown pass. Mm-hmm. No, I can't. I think when seasons pass and new seasons start, you know, you tend to forget some things about games, but that aspect of this game will never be forgotten. Like I said, 20 years from now, they'll remember Dabo Swinney ranking Ohio State 11th. That's what Ohio State fans will remember. And they'll remember Justin Fields and the toughness that he showed to will his team to a victory. And I think his team, if you look at that point in the game, and I don't have it right in front of me, but it just seems like very similar to the way when Trevor Lawrence got hit by Sean Wade and it kind of changed the complexion of the game, his team rallied around him showing his toughness a year ago. Mm-hmm. I really felt that in the same way the Ohio State team rallied around their quarterback for showing that toughness and finding a way to come back out and deal with that pain and go out and keep playing football. And I think Ohio State responded on both sides of the ball to that.
Well said there. And a great reminder of Trevor Lawrence taking a major hit and getting back up. And you could see it just change the vibe on the Clemson line as well as on the sidelines where, all right, our guy's here. He's engaged and he's ready to go. And that's the same thing we saw with Justin Fields. So we've got the Trey Sermon game in the Big Ten title game, and we've got the Justin Fields game in the semifinal. The next question is, how will we define the following week? And that will be the national championship with Ohio State taking on Alabama. And if you're wondering why we're not doing really a Alabama-Notre Dame breakdown, just Najee Harris and Devontae Smith and Mac Jones. they were that dominant. And it felt like when it was 21-7, Bama could come to a point where it's like, how much do we want to score? And that's how it's going to play out. And that's not a knock on Notre Dame. That is a compliment to where Alabama is right now. And with that, setting up that showdown next week, just early on, before you have the week to pour into dissecting and getting ready for the game, off the top of your head, how do you think this matchup will play out? And who will stand out in a game like this?
You know, everyone's going to talk about the quarterbacks leading into the game. And off the top of my head, because I'm just today going to start kind of rolling up my sleeves with film study and prep. But the last couple of days, I've just kind of unplugged. And on Monday, I'll kind of get going. I would just tell you that I think Najee Harris and Trey Sermon and the line of scrimmage will have everything to do with the game. It's Devontae Smith and Mac Jones and all the Sark and all the production through the air. It's obviously big plays and explosives will be a factor. And the same with Ohio State, with Fields, you know, having an ability to stretch the field with Olave and Garrett Wilson. But if you've really watched Ohio State the last three or four games, it's Trey Sermon's become a story. You know, Trey Sermon running the football and making the defense have to respect that aspect of Ohio State's attack, along with Justin Fields and what he can do running. It makes the defense really somewhat handcuffed, because if you don't respect that, then they'll run the ball on you. So it's going to start at the line of scrimmage for Ohio State's offense and Sermon's ability to continue to have big plays. And I'm telling you, Alabama, Najee Harris, the last couple games, with all the talk about Devontae Smith, if you've really watched them, it's, you know, they do so much run pass option, so much play action, that you have to respect Mac Jones. And when you do, and you worry about where the heck is 6, where the heck is 19, where the heck is 8, you worry about all these weapons, that you're light in the box. And if you're light in the box with Najee Harris, you know, he's going to make you pay for that. With his physicality. So who can win the line of scrimmage? Which defensive line can do a better job of not making the defense have to get safeties down to help against the running game? I think will be a big part of how this game goes. And if you ever watch Nick Saban in these big games, he's an old, as much as he's opened things up, he's still an old school guy at the line of scrimmage. And I think you put those two classic brands on the field together. I really think both sides, that the game, when we get done, the game's over. Kind of like what we talked about Ohio State. They just looked physical, more physical than Clemson on both sides. And I think who's more physical in this game, it'll end up being the winner.
I'm looking forward to the chess match where you have the brilliance of Saban as a defensive guy and Ryan Day as the offensive savant, right? And how they move the parts and the pieces here. You mentioned Sark, and that leads into the next conversation that was a huge topic, of course, the day after the semifinal is Tom Herman being dismissed at Texas and Sark taking the job. What were your initial thoughts on the decision by Texas to make a decision like this that surprised everyone? Because a couple weeks ago, it felt like Tom was safe, and then to act fast, and you don't fire Tom Herman and then pay a $24 million buyout to him and his assistants unless you have a guy, and then to target Sark as that guy. What were your thoughts?
First of all, for it to happen the way it happened, this was probably done back in October. This was decided a long time ago. I credit all the parties involved with keeping it quiet. Sark's been going about his business, doing what he needs to do with Alabama. Texas did a nice job honoring Tom Herman and letting them finish their season. There were no leaks of any kind. And then it was a swift move on the back end. And I think that they must have wanted to allow Alabama to play their playoff game. They must have had some kind of understanding. You get through that game, we're going to make a decision or a public announcement and allow you to call that last game, and we'll move on from there. At the end of the day, I think with Texas and Tom Herman, because when he left Houston to go to Austin, I was excited. I know Tom. I'm a big fan of what he can do as an offensive play caller. He did a nice job in a short period of time at Houston as a head coach. And so I think a lot of people wanted to see him take that kind of blueprint to Austin and get it going. Texas is a tough place. We've talked a lot about that. You know, they've got a lot of voices that let their voices be heard behind the scenes and even publicly. And you need a strong personality as a head coach to be able to withstand that. There are a lot of rumors. There's just a lot of gossip. There's just a lot of stuff that is out of your control. And it takes a big, strong personality to come in there and handle that. The last time Texas was Texas was 2009. So the latter part of Mack Brown's era did not go well. Charlie Strong's era did not go well. Tom Herman averaged 8-4 in his 4 years there and 5-3 in conference play. In Texas, when they look in the mirror as a brand, they see themselves as Alabama. They want to be a top five perennial power. They want to be where Oklahoma is, and 8-4 and 5-3 in 4 years, it just isn't going to cut it. So I think they wanted to try to go in a different direction. They wanted to see if they could go out and make a hire and get themselves back to rubbing shoulders, not only with Oklahoma, but with Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, Georgia, all those elite programs. And I'm a big fan of Sark's. I know he's had some setbacks on a personal level. He's owned those. I think he's done an incredible job without thinking about one day I'm going to rebuild myself and one day I'm going to be a head coach again. I'm talking to him from the day or time that he went through what he went through. I really think he just didn't really think about if head coaching would maybe be in his future or not. I just think he went back to trying to take care of himself, trying to do what he can do to get back into coaching. He went back as just an analyst with Alabama and then eventually went back to the NFL with the Falcons as a coordinator, came back to Alabama as a play caller and offensive coordinator for a couple of years. And I think what people are impressed with Sark is not only that he's putting up record-setting numbers as an offensive coordinator, but I think it's just how he's doing it. He's gotten in under Nick Saban. He's learned a lot. And now we just pray for him, man, and wish him nothing but the best, because that's a lot of stress that he's going to take on a personal level. And I hope he's able to surround himself with everything that he needs to take care of himself first and foremost. And if he's able to do that, then it comes down to recruiting and building a culture that I think he learned in Tuscaloosa. And the combination of that in Austin sounds great going in. I mean, but then again, we thought Tom Herman sounded good going in, but I'm a believer in Sark. I'd like to think that it's going to work out for the best, and he's got his hands full, man. I mean, from the high school football programs all the way to Texas, things are different today than they were when Mac Brown had it rolling, you know, from 98 to 2009. High school football in Texas it's become more about 7-on-7 and early verbals and five-star this and five-star that. Texas has got to get back to toughness, absolute tough. And when they took the field against USC, it wasn't 7-on-7 football. That was ass-kicking football. That was being physical and being tough, mentally and physically tough, when they beat SC and Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush. And they have not been that way. And so if I were Sark, I'd want to get back to that. Like, I don't care how many games we win, we're going to be the toughest team that takes the field. They got to live that 52 weeks out of the year, and the way they lift weights and the way they train, the way they, everything they do, it's got to be mental and physical toughness, because they have not been that in a long time. So looking forward to the staff he puts together, and I think it'll work. And I'm pulling for Sark. I always will.
Yeah. And like you said, we just wish him good health, and because it is a stressful job. One of the most stressful jobs in all of college football. You hope he gets one thing that Nick got early on, that Mal Moore made sure, the AD at Alabama, was, hey, he had the board. Back off. Let Nick figure this out a little bit and give him some breathing room. You hope that's the role here for Chris Del Conte to the Board of Regents. Let's just give him some time here. Let's figure this out. We've got to have some recruiting cycles coming through. So the pressure's already going to be there immediately when he walks in Austin. But it's just let him cook. There's going to be certain losses in the beginning, but we've got to figure this out early to get over the hump. And we saw Bama give Nick that time, right? That where they could find the identity of the coach, because then he got his players to settle in. And you hope that he has that time to kind of figure things out, because we haven't seen that at Texas. We haven't seen a coach get the time to develop over time their own recruits.
That's a great point. And I think just for the immediate future, anybody that questions Sark's focus on this game versus Ohio State, you just don't know him. If the last time we ran into this with Lane Kiffin as a play caller, he went through the Washington game. It wasn't the best. And then they had a quote unquote mutual understanding that it was best for him to move on to FAU. And Sark came in there with a young freshman quarterback named Jalen Hurts. And he was the play caller in that national championship game against Clemson. And that was the game where where Deshaun Watson hit runner Hunter Renfrow in the corner at the end of the game to win the game. And this time around, just like we saw with many other coordinators, whether it's been Kirby Smart, Jim McElwain, Jeremy Pruitt, there've been a lot of guys that have had opportunities to coach in one more game with Coach Saban, finish it, and then go take the job, whatever job it is that they took. Many of these coaches have gone off as winners. Many of them had no problem focusing in on that last game and then, you know, take a shower after the game and then move on to your next job. That'll be what Sark will do in this game. It will be all hands on deck. This will not be about putting a staff together, recruiting, or doing whatever he needs to do in Austin. This will be 7 or 8 days of complete focus on Ohio State, on Mac Jones, Najee Harris, Devontae Smith, the offensive line, doing what he needs to do to get his offense ready. And then win or lose, he'll take a shower after the game. He'll get on a plane. He'll head to Austin. And then next morning on January 12th, he's officially the head coach for the Texas Longhorns. But up until then, rest assured, Sark will not have any problem at all locking in on what he needs to do to try to get his team ready to win a game on January 11th.
Cannot wait. 7 days from now, and we hope that you feel better as the week continues. And looking forward to your call with Chris. And let's just hope. We joke around about it, but I think for the audience, let's just hope we have a close game. let's end the streak on Monday night in Miami, right? You deserve it. You and Fowler, the entire broadcast crew, and I think anybody that's around and watches what you guys do on Saturday night. So we deserve a close game.
No doubt. We'll have our fingers crossed, and I'm looking forward to getting down there and being back with my team. And thank you for everything, Kevin. Happy New Year to you and your family. Appreciate everything. And I assume we'll do one more podcast on the back end of the national championship, but it's always a lot of fun to talk about the game with you.
Herbie, appreciate it. Take care, buddy.
Okay, bud.
Good way to start the 2021 year out the gate there with Herb Street to get his thoughts on what he saw and what we can anticipate to see this next week on Monday night. I want to remind our audience, we're going to be back on Wednesday with more as David Pollack will join us with his breakdown of Alabama, Ohio State. Looking forward to that. And maybe we'll look back and get more thoughts about what he thought with Georgia and Cincinnati and that performance and some of the other bowl games, as well as if we have other breaking news in college football in the next couple of days when it comes to coaching movements and Sark's now new job as the head coach at Texas. Big thanks to Taylor Schwenk on the other side, making sure that regardless of year, regardless of day, he's got us covered as a fantastic producer here on the College Football Podcast. Until we talk again, I hope you guys stay safe, social distance, and wear a mask.